Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, Bio member Debbie Applegate talks with Matthew Kennedy about his book on Elizabeth Taylor, An Opinionated Guide, published by Oxford University Press in May 2024. This interview was recorded via Zoom on May 13th, 2024.
I had such a good time reading this book. I'd seen a lot of Taylor's classic films. I think the ones that you would say are among her most notable, and I think most people would. Things like movies like A Place in the Sun from 1951, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Suddenly Last Summer, Butterfield 8, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, that wonderful span of her career between 1951 and 1966, which may be, by some standards, the peak of her career. But I had no idea how many more films she made. I mean, so many more. So one of the pleasures of the book was going to the internet and poking around. I'm going to start in a counterintuitive place. One of the clips I came up with while I was looking up things about Elizabeth Taylor was a clip on YouTube, Jennifer Lawrence, the young actress, talking to the late night comedian and host, Jimmy Fallon. This is in 2013. She's describing going to a fancy showbiz party, and a friendly old lady came up and struck up a conversation with her. And Jennifer Lawrence is terribly embarrassed because the whole time she is absolutely certain that she is talking to Elizabeth Taylor and keeps wanting to say, I love your movies, but couldn't remember a single movie that Elizabeth Taylor had been in, all the while totally unaware that Elizabeth Taylor had died in 2011. I bring this up, this funny little anecdote, because I think it dovetails with what I see as one of the central questions of your book, which is Elizabeth Taylor is an icon who is still remembered to this day, will always be remembered, I dare say. And yet we're not quite sure why we remember her, many of us. We don't know all her film roles, unlike some other icons of the era. So what I thought is I would ask you to start by talking a little bit about Elizabeth Taylor and her career and her fabulous life for those who might not remember her as well.
Well, thank you. And I have indeed, what you're speaking of really resonates with me because I have encountered a number of people, particularly younger people, who draw blank when I mention I've written this book about Elizabeth Taylor. And I have to realize that her fame has really dropped precipitously since she died in 2011. And the last films she made were over 30 years ago. So, you know, she is receding from popular memory. But to be brief, she was born in 1932. She became a child star in 1944 with National Velvet at the age of 12. And she was, from that point on, a major movie star to her death in 2011, even after she stopped making films. She had an amazing ability to maintain a kind of high-end celebrity status, even after her career ceased being active. But what is interesting about her is, and also that also maybe escapes younger audiences, is that she was arguably the most famous woman on the planet sometime around the late 60s and into the 70s. Oftentimes she would be mentioned, her level of fame would be certainly equal to Queen Elizabeth and Jackie Kennedy, other, you know, contemporary women. And this is lost on current audiences because the very things that made her famous have simply receded from consciousness and or ceased to be less notorious in our thinking than they were back then.
Are you thinking about her life or her career?
I am thinking about her life, and I wanted to just briefly touch on her life and then, you know, advance into spending, you know, most of our time on her career, which is the point of the book. But she had many husbands. She was famous for having many illnesses. She was involved in some personal scandals that got public. And so she became a tabloid favorite. You would find her on the, as you're waiting in your shopping line to buy your groceries. There she'd be, usually with her husband, Richard Burton. She was famous for her love of jewelry, for her very extravagant life, particularly in the 60s and into the 70s. You know, it's so easy when talking about her to go down that road, because it really is pretty remarkable and quite dramatic what, you know, her life was. But I have always loved her as an actress, and she was a major actress, and she made 67 films, both if you combine feature films and television. And I wanted to do a deep analysis of those films and her gifts as an actress, also tracing the changes that she made as an actress, as an artist, from her debut in 1942, clear into the early 90s. You know, this epic career. You had pointed out that there were all sorts of films apart from her sort of peak period that you might not have been familiar with. And indeed, in terms of sheer her output, one of her most famous roles was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which came out in 1966. It's often considered her masterpiece as an actor, but that was midway in her career. She kept working. Her output became less and less, and there were greater periods of time between one film and the next. But I remember as a kid, the post-Virginia Woolf years, as I was becoming a great aficionado of film, and I remember thinking, you know, here's this massive star. I was aware of that, and I was aware also that, you know, she kept making one failed movie after another until her career pretty much dried up. I wanted to just dive into that as well. Like, am I going to find hidden gems? Am I going to be disappointed? Am I going to agree with the folks at the time who said, boy, poor Elizabeth Taylor, she's really, you know, her career's really sliding downward. But I felt a responsibility to present her. I'm going to write about her career, to honor her entire career, and to really study those later films and try to do her justice and recognize her not as a celebrity or as a magnet for tabloids, but actually as a great actress.
Well, it was hard as a reader. Every once in a while, I would think, wait, what kind of crazy life thing is happening here? But you really do a lovely job of touching on those, but really keeping it only to what you're really focusing on, which is her as an artist. The longitudinal look of your book really, to me, turned her into a mystery in a way that I had not experienced before. I thought, she was a great actress in the things that I had seen. I do think Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is truly one of the great movies in Hollywood history. And so many of her other movies I really enjoyed. But it is also true that she is not like many other great actresses. Here's what I saw as the central question of your book, that her appeal is nearly universal for many, many years, decades. She has plenty of proof of her stature, 2 Oscars, 5 Oscar nominations, and some of the biggest box office hits of the era, a career that lasts 50 years. But the feeling persists that she wasn't that good an actor. And I have to say, looking at some of her later films and some of her earlier films, I could see that. I could see why you might think that. So maybe we could start on the hardest question. It seems to me that the more you know about her as an actress, the more enigmatic she becomes. That in fact, the more you know about her person, actually the more wide open and human she seems. She does not seem enigmatic as a person. She seems like a larger than life person of tremendous appetite. But as an artist, I think she becomes much more tricky and full of contradictions.
I really like the way you said that, because you touched on something that was challenging to write about. If I understood correctly, you're mentioning her, that she was enigmatic as an actor, as an actress, as an artist. And indeed, I would have to agree. And I don't take, you know, a glowing attitude toward every one of her performances by any means. And I do recognize that she was inconsistent. She hits it out of the ballpark when she does, and when she doesn't, it's just, yeah, I'm scratching my head. Like, what was going on there? but that she was less enigmatic as a person. And having seen every one of her films, that absolutely came true for me, is that if I was going to settle in with one of her films, it was like, you know, saying hello to an old friend. Capturing in writing, I find writing about acting in general is challenging. But for her, it's particularly challenging because, I might sound cliche, she did have a kind of undefinable magic that only the greatest stars have. And the very fact that it's undefinable means it's very hard, if not impossible, to actually write about. And I did my best, but many times what I would do in talking about her performances is I would talk about her technique. And then the magic is seen with anyone who says, okay, now we're going to go watch Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, or now we're going to go watch Cleopatra or whatever. So I would talk about her voice. I would talk about how she uses her body, how she relates to her other actors, how she reacts rather than drives a scene.
There's some irony there because you point out, and she herself sometimes says, I didn't really have technique. What I had was a vast imagination. So I'm curious, her voice is very, well, of course, she's beautiful, although she's not uniformly beautiful over the course of time. She can really change in her looks, unlike some other women of the era. But her voice captures, I think, one of the most interesting things about her career, which is she is one of the last actors to really span the golden era of the machine, the Hollywood machine, and the industry as it was in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And then her great period is that moment when Hollywood is wide open. She's helping force Hollywood into the new era of independent cinema, but she does not thrive in that new era. So you can see her voice serves her very well sometimes, but maybe not later on. And I'm also curious about her sexuality, because of course she's known for being very sexy. She makes a very quick and painless leap from child star to ingenue, and from ingenue almost immediately to vixen. And I'm very curious how you see her sexuality. It seems like she does a lot of pushing of boundaries, not just for herself, but for the field in general.
In my own education for her, when I started this book, there was a period of time that I wasn't that well acquainted with. And it was really between National Velvet and A Place in the Sun, where I'd seen, I think, Little Women and maybe Life with Father, but there were all these other films that she did at MGM where she was 16 years old, approximately, and she was basically presented as somebody who would be a good 5 years older and was asked to take on mature roles. A couple of these films I find very hard to watch today.
What are you thinking of in particular?
I think the number one film that makes me squirm of this type is Conspirator, which came out in 1948, and she is 16, and she's playing the wife of the actor Robert Taylor, who was, I think, 15 years older or something. And she's thrust in all sorts of sort of dire adult situations. Knowing that she was underage simply makes me nervous. It just makes, I can't turn that off when I watch the film. And she has some choice things to say about that, actually. I mean, speaking of sexuality, she said, I was still in school, so I would be, you know, getting my geometry lesson between takes, and then I'd be called back to the set, and Robert Taylor would stick his tongue down my throat. And it's just,
Compared to some stories of many of the actresses of that era, I get the sense that she was more protected from some of the worst behavior of the studio's executives.
I think so. And she has a story to tell about that, where she gets some credit, I think, for that. She was very closely aligned with her mother, who was sort of her unofficial career manager in the early MGM years. Louis B. Mayer, the head of the studio, brought both of them in, and he was critical of something that Taylor's mother, Sarah, had said or did. And he was being rude, and Elizabeth said, "How don't you dare talk to my mother like that. You and your studio can go to hell." She was not so invested that she was going to be deferential to him. She fully expected to be fired immediately, and she wasn't. And she, and again, she was like 15, 14 at the time. She said, "Ah, I am a commodity to this studio. I am a value to this studio. They're not going to fire me for this. And therefore, I get to call some shots here as well. I think that helped give her maybe some higher control than some of her colleagues might have had at the time.
Well, in fact, that's something I wanted to ask about. I found that fascinating. You discussed that explicitly, that incident. And to me, what many people would think is a contradiction, that her great power as an actress and as a career maker came from thinking of herself as a commodity. And yet very few people have had their personal lives intertwine as much. And many artists of the era felt precisely like they were being cramped by being treated as a commodity. How is it that that became, I mean, maybe it always didn't work to her advantage, but it certainly seems like there was plenty of time when it did.
Yes, and I think it also aided her throughout her career, actually, and helped her psychologically. I read many accounts where she wanted to be somewhat pampered on the set. She would be late. She loved getting gifts. She freely accepted lavish gifts, including jewelry, and not just from husbands or suitors, but from co-stars or, you know, she loved flowers, she loved chocolate. And, you know, I'm reading about this thinking, well, that's rather indulgent and diva-ish of her and so forth. I think what's also going on there is that she is realizing that she is indeed a commodity. This movie is happening because she's in it. Yes, she has a high salary, but by golly, look at all these people who are being employed. And I love that she was somewhat apologetic. She was never apologetic about that.
She was never apologetic
about loving champagne and jewels and a jet set life. It might look a little gauche today, especially later on, you know, her post MGM years. But I love that she never apologized. It's true. She made a lot of money for a lot of people.
So did that serve her less well as the studio system breaks down and the era of the 70s and 80s, she just doesn't hit quite the same. What do you think about that? Why so many duds later on?
It is fascinating because, you know, here she was finally free of the shackles at MGM, and she makes some really interesting movies, but they don't do very well. Of course, Virginia Woolf is a spectacular exception, and also The Taming of the Shrew, which she made immediately after Virginia Woolf, which was a very strong take on Shakespeare, in which she proved, yeah, I can do Shakespeare as well, right? You know, I'm an actress, please. She then did a film called Reflections in a Golden Eye, which was directed by John Huston and co-starred Marlon Brando, based on a Carson McCullers short story. It kind of fits within the semi-experimental standards of the late 60s when the studio system was breaking down and certain directors could come forward and do some rather personal work. And it was a bomb. It's a very interesting movie to look at today, but it did very badly in its day. She did other films with a film called Secret Ceremony and Boom. So there are these films in the late 60s that she did in which she was trying to press the audience into something new. If you look at these films, they failed at the box office, but they're interesting. I do like to call them interesting failures. Mm-hmm. You've got Reflections in a Golden Eye. You've got Secret Ceremony. You've got Boom. We might look at them today and laugh at their eccentricities, but Taylor was trying to do something interesting. She wasn't simply phoning it in. These works were by people like Tennessee Williams and William Shakespeare and Carson McCullers, but they simply didn't click. And it might have been because she didn't have the backing of the studios. It might also have been that she simply was too closely associated with the studio era.
I'm also wondering, I haven't seen as much of her later work. I've seen little bits of it. She does not strike me as the type of actor who loses themselves in a role. Perhaps I'm wrong. She may feel differently, but there's a certain kind of uniformity to her acting. You don't see her have vast shifts in tone. I mean, she can certainly get hysterical. She can certainly be maudlin. She can certainly be arch and funny, but she's still Elizabeth Taylor, is often what it seems like. Her voice modulation stays, you know, very similar. Her gestures. I'm curious if maybe she was too much the star to lend herself to these later kind of roles where she was expected to subsume herself more.
I think so. And at that point, her celebrity, again, in the late 60s into the 70s, her celebrity was so vast that I wonder if it was even possible for audiences to go and see anyone but the woman who's on the nightly news because she's getting another divorce, or because she's hospitalized yet again, or because she's hobnobbing with Aristotle Onassis and Maria Callas, you know. And I, you know, a friend of mine and I refer to it as Godzilla at the Tea Party. You simply can't get around the fact that it's Elizabeth Taylor, try as she might, to be giving a performance.
Why do you think she did so many melodramas? Because she's very funny. When she's got a really lovely light touch and arch voice, she has such an amused intelligence. Even when she's being Elizabeth Taylor, you can see how smart she is behind her eyes and how she is looking at this with a warm but also cold eye. Often you get the sense. And I think she did not do enough comedy. There's comic moments. I can't think of anything that's just a straight comedy that I've seen of hers.
I agree. I think she's wonderful at comedy. And I think we have to just sort of look for it in bits and pieces in films that are probably going to be labeled dramas. She talks about, this is again in the 60s, she talks after Life After Cleopatra, which came out in 1963. And she said there's this perception perhaps that because, you know, she's at the top of the world as a box office star and as a celebrity, that she has her pick of films. But in fact, she doesn't or didn't. Right. And that was on account of the misconception that she had caused the great cost overruns in Cleopatra, and that she was difficult and so on and so forth. And that she said, in fact, when she made The Sandpiper, which was in 1965, she and her new husband, Richard Burton, took it because they weren't getting any other offers, not because it was a great movie or because they could negotiate something, a nice romantic comedy, exactly on their terms. They were also somewhat trapped by their own lifestyle. They were living so lavishly and they had so many people on staff that they took what they could get, and for a while were getting very, very high paychecks.
The Sandpiper was an intro. I had not seen The Sandpiper, and it turns out a lot of people found that to be a very, I've talked to a lot of people who said, I took a lot of life lessons from The Sandpiper, because it's really pushing the envelope in many ways on cultural issues. And I think that's one of the things that surprised me about this book, was how much she was pushing at the edges of culture from a really exalted position, actually. And the sexuality, much as she sometimes that irritated her to always be put in sex pot roles. I think that is probably her biggest unappreciated legacy for pushing American sexuality in all kinds of different directions it would not have gone in.
Starting with, say, Butterfield 8, which was her last film at MGM, where she plays a woman. And again, the script is very obtuse, you know, there are censors watching and you had to be somewhat careful. If you're watching closely, what is easily detectable is that she's playing a woman who enjoys sex apart from societal expectations or approval. She enjoys sex, and she might even enjoy sex with much older men, going back to a young experience she had. That was a push, right? And she pushed further with Cleopatra and some of the associations that were there when she was having an open affair with Richard Burton while married to Eddie Fisher. And then Reflections in a Golden Eye is downright kinky in some of its sexual suggestiveness, with Marlon Brando playing a repressed homosexual, Taylor playing a rather sexually interested, frustrated military housewife.
Which is not unlike Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. So maybe, is it possible that as she gets older, we're in the 60s, we're in the, well, no, we're after the 60s, we're in the 70s and 80s, that precisely because so much of her reputation somehow was associated with sexuality, as she gets older, the culture changes, that sort of Zaftig hourglass movie star icon is no longer the hot sexual fantasy of moviegoers, is that perhaps she gets a little left behind for that reason, possibly?
Yes. And I think, you know, the fact that the films of the late, starting in the late 60s, consistently did poorly at the box office and were poorly received by critics. And back then, it was absolutely ordinary for major film actresses to basically be done at
Right.
about 40. She turned 40 in 1972. So that's actually quite consistent with, and you can see her entire generation suddenly out of work as feature
That's right.
film actresses. And the new crop at that point would have been Jane Fonda, Vanessa Redgrave, Julie Christie, Faye Dunaway. These were the hot young things that were getting the roles, even though, you know, Taylor was trying, and maybe more than her contemporaries, to really do some interesting stuff. And she did still have enough clout to do that, at least into the early 70s. Things really decayed further at that point, where the actual quality of her colleagues on various films was just not what it was, even in the late 60s.
So you're saying part of why she survived that, because that was one of my questions. How did she survive for quite so long when so many of her generation did not? That she could carry that clout forward, that she had enough accrued cultural capital to keep working.
Yeah. In the 70s, you see her output declining. There's more and more space between films. Her celebrity is great enough that she can still get attention for films that get a lot of press, films like A Little Night Music and The Bluebird, into the late 70s. And both of them were major box office failures. So it just further eroded her capital as a film star, but never as a celebrity.
Are there any late career gems you would point out?
Well, I would actually. Well, there are two actually that immediately come to mind. And I want to impress that I wouldn't necessarily overall call these movies, you know, anything on a caliber of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or Giant or Suddenly Last Summer, right? I mean, they're not of that ilk, but they do contain very interesting, worthwhile Taylor performances. One is called X, Y, and Z, which is a love triangle from 1972, also featuring Michael Caine. It's really not a very good movie. I mean, it's sort of odd and looks rather hastily put together and so forth. But Taylor, I have the feeling she said, okay, this is a turkey, so I'm going to just have fun. And she absolutely, again, pardon the cliched saying, she chose the scenery in the best possible way. You know, if you want to see evidence of her sense of humor and what she maybe even acted like when the camera wasn't rolling, but this time it was, I would recommend X, Y, and Z. The other film later in the 70s she made in Italy called The Driver's Seat, which is based on a Muriel Spark novel. It is a very disturbing psychological thriller about a woman who is seeking someone who will murder her. This film has an interesting history in the United States because it was only available on poorly transferred VHS copies for a very long time. And that's how I saw it. And I just thought, oh, what a weird, bad movie. And she's just, you know, walking around Rome and doing odd things to herself. And, you know, with this very odd script. I mean, it just looked like a mess. Well, I finally saw a decent transfer. The cinematographer is Vittorio Storaro, who did The Conformist and Reds, a great, great cinematographer. And I finally saw it in a good transfer. Absolute light years difference in terms of my experience of that film. And there are others, not just me, who have said The Driver's Seat is a really remarkable, worthwhile film for anyone who loves Taylor. And she gives a profoundly disturbing performance. I compare it to other films where she was either playing mad or her character was expected to be mad,
yes,
including Suddenly Last Summer,
right,
or Rain Tree County. The contrast here is really stunning. The movie is just crawls under my skin in a way that a good creepy movie should.
So I'm going to end with one last question, the hardest question of all. Is she a great actress?
Well, I will say yes, if we judge great acting by the greatest performances a person turned in. I would not say she was the most consistently or reliably great actress, but you look at her best and I see greatness there. Not just elusive star magic, but I see extraordinary command of the camera, what it's doing, what her face and body are doing. She affects me when I watch these performances, no matter how many times I've seen them. I marvel at her spontaneity and creativity. She said that part of her lack of technique is trusting her intuition. Mm-hmm. So in rehearsals, she was often very controlled and contained, and then would go crazy when the camera was rolling. That's not always the best thing for co-stars to experience, but it does make for some remarkably fresh, spontaneous moments on film. When she's on camera, I can't take my eyes off her.
Well, thank you, Matthew Kennedy. Thanks for the fabulous book and for reintroducing us to this fabulous actress.
Debbie, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That was bio member Debbie Applegate in conversation with Matthew Kennedy about his book On Elizabeth Taylor, An Opinionated Guide. It was published by Oxford University Press in May 2024. This interview was recorded on Zoom on May 13th, 2024. To learn more about bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.